Hi, I'm Gareth. I work with Thoughtworks, but I'm mainly here, or I am here, helping Stockport in doing their digital transformation and building out some of their digital services. And I've been asked to run sort of a half talk, half workshop on sort of some of the decisions we've made at an architectural level, but I'm trying to make it accessible to everyone, really. And so I probably am being a technologist. I'm a software developer mainly. I'm probably going to end up throwing out some jargon. So if it doesn't make any sense, stop me, because the purpose of the talk is to explain this in language which everyone can understand and everyone can appreciate. So please stick your hand up and shout. I've got a couple of slides sort of explaining some of the decisions we made and why we made them. Broadly covering architecture, also covering a few things around team composition and how we get people involved as well. Then, depending on how long this takes, we'll do a bit of a breakout session and happy to answer any questions and see how it goes from that point onwards. Just to get a quick idea, how many people here are software developers or work mainly with software? Cool. BAs or service designers? Cool. Any program managers? Cool. I'm trying to think what else. Some IT managers, relationship managers, social workers? Cool. Counselors? Excellent. Anyone I haven't mentioned, want to call out what their job title is?
Architect.
Cool.
System admins.
Good one, always. Excellent. So, why change, first of all? If you are, one of the ambitions here at Stockport was to design an architecture which could be changed, but why would you want to do that? Sort of the counter argument being, well, if you just get it right the first time, then you won't have to change it. Typically, we see four areas which trigger systems needing to be changed or services needing to be changed. Response to external requirements, so this is a big one in the public sector, both in local government and central government. Policy changes, areas of service are brought into or out of the council, which requires systems to be changed to support those areas of service. Secondly, response to internal factors. Systems get old, things go off of support, end of life, or just a desire to lower the cost of ownership over time. So that's another reason why you may want to change something. Desire to offer new or improved services, that's always a good one. And also just changing user expectations and behaviors. I mean, 5 years ago, not everyone had a smartphone. Now, not everyone has a smartphone, but certainly far more people. Like my parents use Facebook. I never thought they would, unfortunately. So there are sort of drivers for change. Change is inevitable in the IT space. And what this really means is that as organizations, and we've seen this in the private sector, and now we're seeing it move through to the public sector, the attitude of IT departments within organizations is changing. We're moving away from this idea that our job is to manage and defend against change, and moving towards an idea where the view really is to use change to drive value. So in a more traditional IT department, what you tend to see is you try and manage your releases or changes to systems so you have fewer big bang changes. You sort of do, typically once every 6 months, once every 3 months. Change requires complex change management and oversight processes because it's very risky. You work on several big changes at once, typically because one of them overruns, and then you're managing another change in your next change window and then another one in your next change window. And your organization becomes very risk averse because every time you change something, something breaks, because you typically try and change a lot at any one time. And with organizations who've sort of gone on the journey to change things more often, what we typically see is that they do many smaller releases. So they don't try and change everything at once. They focus in on something they want to change, and they sort of get it through the entire process in less than a month. Change management becomes much more decentralized. So the teams who are responsible for a system tend to look after that system. There is no big central change management process. The focus moves away from what do we want to change overall and is sort of focused on what is the most valuable small change we could make next. So things become much more incremental and iterative. And this is in a response to these organizations switching to a more agile delivery model. And also organizations gradually become more risk tolerant. So rather than being a risk averse organization, which tries to really minimize the amount of change you're making at any one time, you become an organization which can tolerate risk, because if you can change, it's much easier to fix things. So your opportunity to fix things is much greater if you can change more often. I should say, if anyone has a question or a comment, please shout as we go. So this is sort of a more visual representation of what I'm saying. If you manage change in small batches, the amount of risk, which is the sort of orange square in play, is much smaller at any given time. Whereas if you try and batch all of your changes up into one big release or one big change, as we see on this side of the diagram, you have a lot of sort of work in play, a lot of risk that isn't delivered, and then if you fail that one big release, you failed everything. Whereas if you do many small releases, many small changes, you've at least always got something in play, something delivering value. The two main sort of ways of doing this in the IT space are continuous delivery and DevOps. They are sort of two umbrella terms which govern a lot of the techniques and practices used by organizations to, in both IT and software development, to get to the state where they're capable of releasing many small changes often rather than sort of fewer changes, but bigger changes far less often.
We're doing both approaches at the same time.
Continuous delivery and DevOps, or the approach to change?
And the continuous changes. It's the norm for us at the moment,
having
to. Mm-hmm. That's the way the market's going, isn't it?
Yeah, it's typically you do both at the same time. What we are seeing in the industry is sort of a transition from one to the other. Historically, it was much more big bang changes, but over time, as systems become and vendors become more amenable, we are moving to these smaller releases, and I'd hope that we are sort of focused in having as fewer big bang changes as possible. So I think it's very hard to categorize things as only big bang or small changes, but certainly you want to be making the smallest number of changes you can, which are valuable. But it's a very good point. We will sort of, for a number of years, there will be sort of both processes, and you have to manage the associated risk appropriately. What we wanted to do with the architecture here, because we were building it sort of from scratch in a lot of cases, was let's build a system where we can make these small changes, which is much more sort of or much easier for the organization to do in the long term. So the first principle that really guided our architecture was this idea of something called REST, or representational state transfer, which sounds pretty complicated, but it is just the idea. It's the same principle that the internet works on. First of all, you share representations rather than the resources themselves. So rather than saying, give me the cup, what you're saying is describe the cup to me. And if you describe it in enough detail, someone will be able to use it. This works much better with data. The second principle is everyone has a shared vocabulary for interacting with resources. When I say everyone, is every system has a shared vocabulary which everyone understands, but that vocabulary is very simple and it's extensible. You can change it quite easily. It's made up of verbs, so get, post, put, delete, so sort of simple operations. And every resource that you want to access has its own URL or unique resource location, unique resource or URI, unique resource identifier. The idea being that any system can say, I want to get a bank account, and this is the location of a bank account. You can then send the system that's requesting it a representation of that bank account, which is suitable for that system to use without ever exposing the actual underlying storage mechanism or underlying data itself. So you are giving people as much as they need in order to do the job, but no more than that. And crucially, you're not giving people access to your sort of your core database, your data under the hood, because if that changes and gets broken, then you're sort of in dire straits. The other sort of principle we were looking at is what some in fancy terms is loose coupling, high cohesion, but more simply is just have everyone talking in the same language, but how they actually, you don't care about the thoughts going on in their head, you just care about what they're saying. In this way, it's much like a conversation. It's very easy to add new people to the conversation, for people to step out of the conversation, providing they're speaking the same language. So this is really saying that systems should all agree how they're going to talk to each other, and ideally do it in an open and extensible way. But the actual underlying systems, how those systems manage their data and what their responsibilities are, that is the job of the system itself. So in terms of what computer language are we writing things in, what database solution are we using, that you're free to make that decision on a system-by-system basis. The only real constraint is that every system must take part in the same conversation and have the same API standards. And these are, again, the same API standards that the internet uses, because the internet is a great example, probably the best example we have of a distributed fault-tolerant network. You know, the internet works. If one website goes down, the rest of the internet remains working. And we wanted to use the same principles for Stockbot's architecture. If the council tax system goes down for maintenance, for instance, we want everything else to continue working. And when it comes back up, we just want it to seamlessly start working again. And the other reason for doing this is isolating change. So when you follow these two principles, this principle of sharing representations rather than the things themselves, and this principle of... the previous principle, mind has gone blank, of sort of loosely coupling and having as few dependencies as possible, it pushes you to split your system into smaller parts with very clear responsibilities. And that's the real advantage if you want to start making these smaller changes rather than big ones, because you can reason much more easily about the change. If you have a system that's just responsible for one thing, you know what the impact of changing it is. If you have a system which is responsible for many things, then it's much harder to reason about what you may affect by changing it. And this is sort of the opposite of the more traditional sort of packaged solution or monolithic approach to architecture. If you buy, for instance, a packaged payment solution which deals with everything to do with payments, so reporting, databases, the citizen-facing UI, the council-facing UI as well, then if you want to change one aspect of that system, you effectively risk all of that system. So just by changing the reporting layer, you could break the citizen-facing UI. Whereas if you can decompose that system into smaller pieces, each with their own responsibility, you're much freer to change one part of it, and that may well stop working, but the other parts of the system can continue to work, providing they're built in a fault-tolerant manner. Unfortunately, the internet and a lot of the technology that's been pioneered off of the back of the internet, has given us a great sort of shared resource and shared knowledge of how to build these systems very well. And if you build systems using this technology, you can take advantage of the work that Google, Facebook, Twitter, and everyone else has done in this space, because much of that code is open-sourced and available to use. And the final sort of thought on architecture is, by going down this road of decomposing things into smaller services which are well rationalized, you can make much better decisions about whether you build by user software as a service model and how those change over time. And this is really where we start to look at architecture. Maybe going back to this picture here, it's actually the arrows that are far more important than the boxes. It's the way things talk to each other that really defines how you can change your architecture. And if you decompose your architecture in a way like this, which uses a common sort of standard for everyone talking to each other, and if you align that standard to something which is widely used, like the internet, you can start to say, for this piece of my architecture, which is broadly commodity, so for instance, sending emails and notifications to people, everyone does that. So you can very cheaply buy an off-the-shelf solution or use a software as a service solution, which uses open standards, the same standards that the internet uses. You wouldn't want to run that yourself, because people are doing it. Amazon sends millions of emails a week, and they offer that as a service. And you can send an email for sort of 0.0004 US cents. Whereas running that service internally yourself is very expensive. However, there are areas where the council is very specialized. For instance, the website, the council really owns the relationship between a citizen and that citizen's services and that citizen's places. And the council needs to be able to change that as rapidly as possible in response to the four areas which I outlined earlier. That makes absolute sense to build internally, because we want to own it, we want to change it, and we want to be able to improve it over time. And by using an architecture like this, we can plug the pieces together. We can say, this bit, because it speaks to the core of what we do, we're going to build it, it's going to be bespoke, and it's going to be highly customizable and easy to change. This bit, because it's still important, but it's more of a commodity, we're going to find an appropriate solution where we can get a high degree of, I guess, availability and trust by buying from someone like Amazon. But they'll talk to each other. And you know what? If Amazon becomes too expensive, because this is, again, a commodity service, we'll swap out for someone else, or we'll investigate bringing that in-house at a future date. And finally, a quick plug for Jim's talk later on open source, because one of the decisions we've made here is, as much as possible, we want things to be at least developed in the open, and we want to use open standards. Two main drivers for this, really. Open standards and open source avoids vendor lock-in. If you keep your data in an open format and insist that your vendors are able to report data in an open format or an open standard, so that's a standard where everyone agrees on a common way of describing data, and that standard is looked after by an organization which isn't interested in patenting it or licensing it, you're able to easily share and reuse your data. If you move away from one storage solution, so long as your data is in an open standard, you can move on to another one quite easily. And open sourcing the code, again, one, it prevents vendor lock-in, and two, it allows other people to build on top of and improve what's already been built. And when you're building a public service, that's generally, it's a great idea because many people have an interest in improving public services. If you want to know more, go to Jim's talk later on. So finally, I wanted to talk about people because it's all well and good having an architecture, but without a good team of people, you're not going to implement it well. And there's a bit of a myth in software development that you need to find the mythical sort of a unicorn or rock star developers who are 100 times more productive than everyone else and expect sort of appropriate rock star salaries. But that's not really sort of in our experience at Thoughtworks and working with many other clients as well. What we've found is that it's much more important that you have a highly aligned, highly motivated team than having a few brilliant individuals in that team. In fact, quite often having a team of aligned people and one brilliant individual is a recipe for disaster because people don't get on. But growing and building this architecture is challenging because it's not something which is typically done in the public sector. But there are a series of well-known practices which can be applied to make software development reasonably easy and to go at pace and to be reasonably risk tolerant. And the main way of doing that is you need a team that has a clear view of the organization's vision, principles, and goals. Because by changing more often, you're introducing uncertainty. And what you want in periods of uncertainty is for people to be self-organizing and self-directing. And the best way of doing that is for everyone to have a shared goal and a shared vision. Because then, even if the instructions get lost, people know broadly what they're aiming for, and you can largely trust them to do the right thing. And finally, practices. So I'm going to rattle off some of the practices we're using here to really enable us to build this architecture which changes at pace. Automated testing. So rather than having, we do have manual QAs as well who go through the website and look for things which a computer can't easily spot. But one of the things we have is extensive automated testing. So we're able to run a series of scripts which tell us if the software is working and ready to be released or not. And we run this after every single change, so we immediately know if we've broken something, crucially before it goes into production. Continuous integration. So this is the practice of every time you change a system, you apply that change to a test system and see if you've broken something. It goes hand in hand with the automated testing. And this means every change we make, we test whether it's suitable to go live. And once you're in a position to do that, you can move on to continuous delivery, which is basically saying, if I have a high level of confidence that all of my changes can go live, then they should go live. We're not going to worry about releases anymore. They're just going to become a daily practice. We're going to release as often as we need to. And finally, DevOps, which is really, it's a very overloaded term in software development at the moment, but at its heart, what it means is the operations team and the development team working together for a cross-team and a higher level goal. So we typically, in IT departments, we incentivize the operations and the admin team to resist change and the development team to make as much change as possible. It's sort of developers, you need to go faster. Operations people, you need to stop things from being broken. And the best way of stopping things from breaking is preventing change. Whereas if you bring those two people together and you give them a higher level organizational goal, like our goal is to both build a new website, but also ensure that website is always available and doesn't break, then you get a much more productive work environment. People are generally much happier because you don't play the game where software developers blame the operations department and the operations department don't trust the software developers. And crucially, again, people are able to make these self-organizing, sort of self-directing decisions. And really, this is what you need for pace. You can't have the organizational overhead of communicating between teams if you want to make changes more than once a day, more than once a week. So that's sort of where I am with introducing us and sort of giving people a very brief overview of the architectural decisions we've made. What I'd like to do next is there are a couple of pieces of paper stuck to the wall, one for sort of architecture questions, one for technical practices, and one for people and teams. If people have any questions, let's take 10 minutes to just walk around. There are some Sharpies here. Write up any questions you have. Have some smaller conversations in groups. Any observations you've got, write from the pieces of paper. We'll then collect those in, and we'll sort of, as a group, discuss and address those topics. And equally, if anyone has any sort of insights they'd like to add, please do so as we go. So if we take 5-10 minutes to sort of walk around, have a few conversations, write on the pieces of paper, and then we'll collect it in and answer those questions. Absolutely.
Said this will be a test to see who's used to an agile environment.
It's a bit of that. Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, just on the walls, yeah.
So, I was one of my issues of an agile project is discovery. Feedback discovery is where the business come up with their requirements. And generally, our team are part of that discovery session.
They aren't, well, because the short answer is because I imagine they're doing it wrong, but. It's
technology that can say, well, actually, you might want to do this
problem. I think it's we're in this difficult transition at the moment in the industry where there's sort of IT and software development are often viewed as two different things. And quite often you'll find the software development department are invited to the discovery and IT aren't. And we really need to bridge that gap, whether it's via the DevOps model of working more closely together or via a different model of just getting invited. Because, it's moving sort of in the first slide where I talked about sort of moving from one model to another of IT. It's really starting to view IT as one of the key providers of value for an organization rather than as sort of a cost center that we want to run for as cheaply as possible.
That's the other thing, isn't it? The IT can often say, well, actually, you could do this, but it's going to be far too expensive.
At the moment, it's only really sort of trying to put the heating up.
Yeah, I was freezing. I was actually sort of shivering before I started.
So good. I've learnt a lot.
Excellent.
You can take me through that some of the time, and I can learn even more.
Excellent.
I'm not totally sure everybody's quite got the idea what they're doing, but.
That's.
What were things you're asking? Right, questions?
Yeah, just any questions or conversations. Typically, if you give people 5-10 minutes to talk about these things, they come up with something worth talking about. But,
if you need a host or something for each area to.
Yes.
Ask questions or whatever. How long have you worked with them?
Stockport. I've been here for about a year. Fort
Worth.
Yeah, been at Fort Worth about 5 years, but Stockport, I've been here about a year. Yeah. Well, where are you from?
I'm Stockport. I'm a councillor, but I'm a software engineer, which is why
I'm
here.
Of course. I see. So. Excellent. Excellent.
Fascinating to find out what's happening underneath. When you said architecture, I thought we might get. I don't know what level we're all at, so it's quite.
It's challenging when you have people at different
absolutely,
levels.
Absolutely, you've got a huge variation.
Yeah.
I suppose the idea really about this is to give other councils an idea. Yeah, we'd like to share it.
Exactly.
So it's more of a.
I think
it's just general organisation.
Getting that high level awareness in there, so people start saying, is it open source? Is it extensible? How do we change it?
Yeah.
And those questions are really the way into how we start to
and
share
how much
things.
How much interest are we getting from other councils around the country?
I think at the moment a lot of people. It's the kind of idea where no one will say it's a bad idea because it's very sort of very appealing. We really need one or two people actually doing it. And I think, hopefully today we'll find those people who are willing to actually. And it's good that we've got the buy-in on the program now to start doing the work to open source some of the stuff. Because I think as soon as one person does it, you can start to talk about it, like Tom was saying, talk about it, make a bit of a song and dance, build for momentum.
And how is it going?
I think it's pretty good. Very pleased with the web publishing and the website. That's going very well. It'd be good to get DTS, the sort of the more citizen sign-on part of that, released as soon as possible, so we can start validating a lot of that in the hands of real people. Yes.
That's when it starts to get really exciting.
Yes.
That we can actually do things with it. And yeah. Just one sign in and you can do everything, and then suddenly everything starts to integrate.
Yeah.
What's
actually underneath the back end? So the back end is .NET, but we're using .NET Core, which is an open source version that runs on both Linux and Microsoft operating systems,
okay.
Which is allowing us to use AWS for some of the less sensitive hosting.
Yeah.
So, or AWS does support Windows servers, but it costs a lot more.
Some of it is actually being held externally then.
Yes, the publicly available stuff, we're using AWS, and we're also using Amazon's web caches, because, or CDN.
Speed and
yes.
It's very hard to duplicate.
Yes,
that, isn't it?
Exactly. The DTS.
All the transactional stuff's internal.
The front end is external. The core data and everything is held internally, and Jim and the sort of DevOps guys have done a lot of work to build a secure connection between Amazon and Stockport.
Yep.
So we're able to into a VPN basically, so there's no danger of leaking any private information.
Is that something Amazon do generally for you?
They offer that functionality, yeah. You just have to be able to configure it at your
it takes
end.
It's a while to get your head around Amazon and yes. Google stuff. Google's even worse, isn't it? Google's even more odd if you're not used to it.
Yeah, Amazon seem pretty good at doing the documentation and getting people rolled on. Google are a bit more like, do it our way or go away. But.
And it's harder to make things actually line up with Google. You might get a different answer in a minute from what you got last time.
Right. Looks like most people have done, so I'm like, hey. Hi, good to meet you.
You just want us to give some like pointers or what sort of problems you might have had when you've done what you've done, like the changes. So
anything like that would be really good.
So have you like kind of adopted an agile sort of way of working, is that what you've done?
Yes, yeah.
Right, okay.
If we take one more minute and then I'll collect things in.
So I hope you don't mind for writing it on the long one there. So I
started
writing the second one, I realised can you continue to deliver on that one over
there?
Oh,
that's absolutely fine. Do you want to join in on the what's going on? It makes me seem less like the Oracle. Oh, I don't. Actually, if you contribute from the back, it might be a bit more interesting. Yeah. Thanks. Ooh. Okay, so we've got about 10 minutes before the end of the session, so I'll start to go through the questions. So rather than sort of a voting process, I think I'll just pick the top one from each and keep going until we run out of time. This isn't just about me answering people's questions, because that will get boring very quickly. So if anyone else has any comments or opinions, and indeed I've got my colleagues Sean and Jim as well, and the Stockport guys, of course, if you want to shout out at any time, please do, because otherwise, again, this is just going to be a lot of me talking at you. So if we start with architecture, we have... I think, how easy is it to decompose existing software architecture? And this is one of the things we looked at Stockport when we first arrived, was what does the existing estate look like? How do those systems talk to each other? And is there an opportunity? How do we really crack that? How do we get into that? And I think the first step in any sort of decomposition is you have to understand what you want your eventual state to be. You don't want to define it too much, but you know, we definitely had the view that we wanted to move to sort of restful, more decomposed systems. And in all, so the first step was really, let's identify some systems and find a way of making them able to participate in the integration that we were planning for the eventual architecture. And so what we did here was we recommended building a series of smaller services on top of existing systems so that they could take part and expose RESTful APIs. Some of the systems already exposed RESTful APIs, which was quite useful. Other systems we needed to build sort of a shim on top of them. And the reason for doing that was we didn't want the existing architecture to sort of sneak in and become a point of failure or a strong coupling onto the new architecture. So we deliberately isolated them. But certainly that's what I would recommend, is you have to look at your existing estate and then identify opportunities to make those systems take part in the new level of conversation, ideally by building a small separate shim on top of them rather than trying to change a legacy code base, because that could impact on the service and availability of existing sort of business line services that you're offering. I don't know if Sean or Jim have anything to add there.
I've got a comment, actually, which is about APIs. There's quite a lot of software that's grown up in the new system of local government. I guess probably from the 90s onwards, a lot of it probably has its roots in the 90s. And there's a lot of actually domain knowledge in some of those systems that are used in local government. Over years, it's been discovered how systems work. And I think the architectural challenge is how to get them to talk to each other. So I think there's actually an opportunity for some of the vendors of the traditional software to add APIs to their software. And I think there's a short-sighted view that by not adding APIs, there could be like a way to make some money. Like, let's charge every client. I'm not saying that any supplier can do it, but like let's charge every council like $20,000 to add an API for everything they want. I think there's an incredible opportunity for some of those systems to add APIs to start to build an ecosystem of systems. Because actually, I mean, if those existing systems don't have APIs added, there's no way to extend them. There's no way to adapt them. So you're going to have to stick with them and just be locked in until you replace it with something with an API. So I think there's an incredible opportunity, actually, and I hope to see, with some of this change that we're seeing in the industry, some of the vendors actually adding APIs onto their software, and this will add an incredible set of opportunities to the local authorities then to extend it. I guess the negative way of saying that is if you've got an existing architecture which doesn't have APIs, it's incredibly difficult to get data in the system without APIs. Incredibly difficult. Yeah. Incredibly
Certainly something to think about when procuring or evaluating new systems is, do they have APIs? Do those APIs use common open standards for sharing data? And if they do, that's definitely a point in those systems' favour, because it means you're guarded against lock-in and you have an opportunity to build on top of that system, which you wouldn't have otherwise.
Don't you think that's a sort of change in the industry? Because, I mean, say 5 years ago, very few people would have heard the word API.
Mm.
No, now, it's almost an acceptable, and as you just pointed out there, almost A, an acceptable part of the industry, and B, it's almost a requirement, it's becoming a requirement.
Yeah.
How do you move that forward quickly then? Because when back in the day when customer relationship management systems were first in place 10, 12 years ago, this was an issue then, and it's still an issue now, so how do you get that change?
If you're a strong buyer and you act in unison to say, you know, this is a feature that we want, then I can't see how vendors can...
I was going to say, the best way to solve this is to stop buying systems that don't have APIs. Just don't buy them, and then that's on an API.
Have you ever tried to get 6 councils to cooperate, let alone please?
I think it's fair to say we've found two schools of counter, really. There's those suppliers that really do see this as an opportunity in the way the market's going, and are developing APIs, core component of their system, and they see it as a real sales point. I think there's them, and Alison knows where I'm going, I think there's then the others who see it as a business opportunity. So, you know, they're developing them, but they very much see it as an add-on and something that is, I wish it was just 20,000, you know, a lot of money really to buy into this API capability. But I think the point comes back to is it's about always being strong buyers and actually starting demanding this, which is not so easy when you're in the middle of a contract, when you're moving to new contracts, or even threatening to go out to procure again. I think there is some bargaining power in the council.
Cool. That might move us on to the next one, because I think we have about 5, we could probably push it to 10 minutes remaining. So technical practices, the first one is how do you stop scope creep? From experience, the best way of doing this is just demoing software early and building the simplest thing that works first, because quite often the scope creep is a way of trying to guard against sort of every eventuality. But if you show someone something that works as early as possible, they quite often say, you know what, that's good enough, let's move on to the next bit. And so equally, it's about surfacing the cost of actually doing that extra piece of work versus the cost of doing something else to the system. So, you know, it's kind of perfect being the enemy of good often. But this comes back to the sort of agile practice of releasing something early, demoing it to people early and saying, is this good enough? Should we move on to doing something more valuable? Rather than focusing in on the requirements very strongly and saying, okay, we need to keep going until we've met the requirements.
Our biggest problem is balance between agile on our own traditional project management and chasing targets, especially financial targets. So a lot of us now are doing these things in an agile way, and doing as you just described there. Here's a release. So I don't need a big spec up front anymore. I'll just think we know what you want, here's a bit of show it here, and then keep adding to it. Now, of course, IT professionals don't like some of that, because give me a proper spec and I'll build it properly. I mean, it's going to take longer. But if people will accept it in project management world to say, actually, I know we said a week, but I've showed you something and now you want a bit more, so now it's 3 weeks. Just accept that and the ability of agility in there. And I think there's huge conflict between agile, traditional project management, and chasing budgets and money. Because everybody wants it by that date. And if that's a project-based thing, and we're trying to do it in an agile way, with very clear specifications, and it's a real conflict for us.
Yeah, I think it goes back to sort of that idea of being able to share goals and visions for the organisation as opposed to necessarily dates and targets. Although dates and targets are still useful at some level, but being able to say the reason we have this date or this target, and being able to agree that the reason this date is here is because the old system goes to end of life, or because we need to get X number of users onto the system by this date, that's a much it's much easier to negotiate around something like that than it is to negotiate around a deadline. And being able to facilitate those conversations is what really bridges the gap between an agile world and a more traditional project management world.
I would also raise that the iron triangle is still real, right? You can't add extra time or result. You may not be able to add extra time resources. So if someone achieves something extra, either the deadline has to move or something has to go out. And that discussion is exactly the same discussion we've always had. It's the same discussion we had before Agile, same discussion we'll have after Agile is gone. If someone wants extra stuff, you have to be strong enough to say no, or strong enough to say, yes, you can have it, but you have to trade out something else. It's the same discussion. It's going to always be the same.
It's a slightly different discussion we used to have. In saying, there's a spec, right? Yeah. There's a spec. Mm-hmm. It's like what you're going to get, and I'll build what you're going to get. Mm. We don't do that now.
But you should start.
We kind of say, what do you really want? I want a payment engine. Okay, right, we'll go and build your payment engine. I want it to do this as well. Okay, so the agile thing works, it's great, and it helps in co-design, it helps in co-production. All of those things are great, but you're gonna have massive slippage. And people are going to accept that massive slippage, and unfortunately organisations do not, because they're being chased by the money side of it over here.
I think, you know what Tom Lisbon says about the system of thinking? I thought you gave a fantastic example, and I'm quite privileged to hear that, actually, because I've been trying to get him to tell me about his time at UC for ages, and he's just been so tight there. Whereas I think there's some reports have been released now, and he's more willing to talk about it. But you know when he talked about the booking system, and he said their target was an outcome. Their target was that people should be able to get a booking. The target wasn't that they should be able to build, like, oh, we need a booking system. If they'd have said, like, our target is to build a booking system, exactly what you said, it's in the business plan, where is it, chase, scope creep, that's going to happen. But actually they just said, well, we want people to be able to book an appointment. And then they delivered it with very little code. I mean, it would just be some HTML, I guess, ringing this number, you know, and they put a call center in place, and it's done. So I don't know if Agile is the solution for that. I think it's the systems thinking stuff, mm-hmm. to say, let's define outcomes. And let's measure the outcome, rather than saying, let's make a statement of what the instrumentality is and then track against that.
Sorry, Steve, you've been trying to...
Because this is something we have tussled with a lot, you know, or still tussled with, you know, macro level, you know, on a daily basis, how to prioritise, you know, the product teams, any sort of professional graphic retail, like different feeling labour, you know, ask us to do less and we'll do more. Which is a real, like, bit of a trip level government, because you've got to have an answer for everything level and you're working on everything at the same time. And at the macro level, I think, particularly trying to work with the elected members to understand the scale of this. And, you know, other than just reflecting on the fact that they're shared problems and there's nothing necessarily that we've done to correct it, but we have focused on it a lot. And I think this coming out from kind of the corporate centre and encompassing IT, but not coming from IT, has probably helped with that. Because, you know, there are, you know, decision making, it's an art, not a science, and it's that middle tier that applies it as a science and a set of rigid rules, whereas actually, you know, if the organisation's trying to learn and work in a different way, it can take calculated risks, etc. And there's some of the work I think we've done on the financial justification for the programme, for the benefits and management approach, some of the approaches we've taken to engage with elected members on an ongoing conversational type journey are really, really replicable elsewhere. It goes back to what Carrie was saying, if you're not trying to do the bottom part of that Venn diagram around organisational change, you're just trying to do service design and product design, then you're not going to lock in the benefits, because the corporate organisational call keeps spitting it out and saying this doesn't conform to how we expect, you know, things to be run. So it's a really crucial issue. I think it's definitely something that's sitting on the potential of these sorts of ways of working, but ones that can be overcome. And if anyone's from that background and interested in the whole risk management, benefit management, financial management side of it, then we can tell that story as well.
Do one more, but if anyone wants, is sort of burning for an answer to their question, I'm happy to stick around afterwards and continue answering things. So on teams and people, we had DevOps. Operations typically on a lower grade, how to encourage participation in the process. I guess the easiest answer is get them off of the lower grade, but you know, far easier said than done. Techniques I've used with teams in the past has been the operations department defined a series of things which your application had to do working with the developers in order to be sort of operated by the department. So they said it must report sort of disk usage in this manner, it must report uptime in this manner. And if you do that, then we promise to look after your application and treat it well. Because, you know, people care about what they build, and so that's quite a powerful thing to be able to say, if you build to this standard, we will we promise we'll treat it nicely. Whereas if you don't, we're just not going to be responsible if it breaks. So that's one technique. But really, that's just a proxy for fostering communications between people. There's a lot of power in just getting people to sit next to each other. I've worked in organizations where operations has been in a completely different building, typically in the basement, and software development has been on sort of a nice fourth floor office somewhere. And a lot of that job was just running between the two buildings, trying to get people to talk to each other. And I think it goes back to this idea that money isn't the only motivator, although in an organization which is where there's perhaps a high degree of cynicism to change, it often becomes a reason for... There's a good saying, which is, you know, salary is generally a reason not to do something, but it's seldom a reason to actually do something. And people will quite often sort of sit there and say, well, I don't get paid enough to do this. But if you flip it around, then actually, you know, what do they care about? Most people care about doing something valuable. And if you can come back to articulating what is the value in moving operations away from just your job is to pull levers and push buttons and ring this number if a red light blinks more than 3 times, and moving it towards, you know, your value to the business is you actually keep the website running. And that's pretty important, because if the website isn't running, then people can't pay their council tax, people can't find a homeless shelter, people can't do these things. That's actually, you know, that begins to become empowering. And those are the conversations you need to start to have with people. And it requires viewing people's jobs differently and moving away from a world where ops is very much in the basement, out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah, simple thing. For a year, ran WK ops at Aviation House, sort of for GBS. And they made the mistake of putting us round the corner from all the devs. People all turned up with their, you know, fixer bikes and their sort of fixer coffees. With the male ones and others had beards, and, you know, we had a different style of that team. But they got us around the corner, and it was ridiculous, some of the problems that we had. So actually, it's really simple, but just put developers closer to the operations people physically in the same physical space makes an incredible difference. And it made an incredible difference at GDS when we made that change. It's really obvious that, you know, like having meeting more teams isn't good.
Cool. I think we'll call it there for purposes of getting lunch, which is served outside. But if people, I will stick around for a while if people want to keep going. But if anyone does want to, thank you.